This is lecture 4 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul. It is entitled The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita and the Significance of the Pauline Letters, given on December 31st, 1912. Already in the beginning of yesterday's lecture, I pointed out how varied are the impressions we receive when we let the calm, dispassionate, wisdom-filled character of the Bhagavad Gita work upon us. Then think of what pervades the epistles of Paul, the personal opinions and aims, passionately expressed, often in a spirit of agitating propaganda, at times even with temperamental scolding or with boiling rage. In the Gita, the way its spiritual content comes to expression reveals a wonderful, artistically rounded form, so perfect that we can hardly conceive it more so, both as poetry and philosophy. In contrast, in the Pauline epistles, one often finds such an awkwardness of expression as makes it very difficult, a real hindrance in ferreting out his deep meaning. In spite of all this, it is true to say that these epistles give the tone and establish the directives for the development of Christianity, as the harmonized tones of the Eastern world concepts come to expression in the Gita. Indeed, in the epistles, all the significant truths of Christianity are to be found. Those regarding the resurrection, the meaning of faith as compared to the law, the nature of grace, the life of Christ in the soul or in human consciousness, and much else. All this is put in such a way that again and again, in presenting Christianity, one must proceed from these Pauline epistles. Everything in them relates to Christianity, as the Bhagavad Gita relates to the great truths about freeing oneself from the immediate activities of living, so that the soul may sink itself into observing everything, into contemplation, into raising itself to spiritual heights, and purifying itself, in short, in preparing itself for union with Krishna. Everything here characterized shows how difficult it is to make a comparison between the two spiritual revelations. One who does so superficially would doubtless give a higher place to the Gita because of its purity, serenity, and wisdom. But if he does so, it is as if he had before him a full-grown plant with a beautiful blossom, and beside it a seed, and then says, "This plant with its gorgeous, fully developed blossom is much more beautiful than the insignificant plant seed." But it might be that out of the seed would come one day a still more beautiful plant and blossom. One does not make a true comparison when one looks directly from a fully matured plant to an entirely undeveloped seed. So it is as if one compares the Bhagavad Gita and the epistles of Paul. In the Gita is the fully ripened fruit, a wonderfully beautiful outgrowth of human evolution throughout thousands of years, which finally comes to a ripe, wise, and artistic expression in the sublime Gita. In the epistles is the seed of something entirely new, which grows and must continue to grow. Only when one sees it as germinal, as prophetic of what could come of it after thousands and thousands of years of development into the future, can one sense the full significance of this steadily ripening seed laid into the human soil by the Pauline epistles. For a true comparison, this has to be considered. Then it is also clear that what some day should be great had first to pour out of the human soul in a homely, chaotic form from the depths of the Christianity in these epistles. Thus the significance of the Gita and the epistles for the collective evolution of mankind on earth must be judged differently, not merely according to the beauty, wisdom, and inner perfection of form to be found in a finished product. For a comparison of the two world concepts given in the Gita and the epistle, one must first ask what is their main concern. Through being able to view in historical perspective everything connected with these concepts, we see that their chief concern is with the entrance of man's ego into the stream of human evolution. If one traces this process, one finds that in pre-Christian times, this ego lacked independence. It was still rooted in hidden depths of the soul. Not yet was it possible for it to develop itself. This could only come about through the inthrust of what we call the Christ impulse. That which can take place since the mystery of Golgotha, and was expressed in the words of Paul, quote, "Not I, but Christ in me," unquote, could not have existed previously in the human ego. But in the millennium before the mystery of Golgotha, when the Christ impulse was drawing nearer, there was gradually prepared what then should occur through the entry of this impulse into the human soul. It was prepared in such a way as came to expression in the deed of Krishna. Within himself, then, in the sense of the Pauline formula, quote, "Not I, but Christ in me," unquote, man had to seek the Christ impulse after the mystery of Golgotha. Before that event, it had to be sought as a revelation coming to him out of the cosmos. And the further back one goes in time, the more brilliant, the more impulsive one finds this outer revelation to be. So we can say that previous to the mystery of Golgotha, a certain revelation came to mankind from outside, like sunlight streaming down upon an object. In such a way did the light of the spiritual sun illuminate man's soul from outside, enveloping it in light. After the mystery of Golgotha, the Christ impulse worked within the soul like spiritual sunlight, as if the soul were a self-illumining body radiating its light from within. Looked at in this way, the fact of the mystery of Golgotha becomes a significant borderline in human evolution. Before the Christ impulse entered the soul, it was like a drop shining with the light radiating into it from every direction. After this mystery, if the soul had taken in the Christ impulse, light streamed out from it as from an inner flame. With this in mind, we can express this whole relationship with the designations we learned to know in the Sankhya philosophy. If our spiritual eye, EYE, is turned to a soul that before the mystery of Golgotha was shone upon by spiritual light from every side, it appears to be in the sattva condition. In contrast, after this mystery had taken place, the soul appears as if the spiritual light were hidden in its depths, the soul's own nature concealing it. It is as if the soul's substance ensheathed the light that contains the Christ impulse. Now, is this not the situation up to our time, especially in our own time, in regard to everything man experiences externally? Observe a man today, as he has to be occupied with outer knowledge and activities. Then, how, like a small flame giving a feeble light, the Christ impulse lies deep within him, enclosed by the other contents of his soul. In contrast to the pre-Christian condition called sattva, this relationship of spirit to soul is the tamas condition. Viewed in this way, what did the mystery of Golgotha bring into human evolution? It transformed the manner of spirit revelation from the sattva condition to that of tamas. Through this, humanity advanced, but it also constituted, one might say, a deep fall, not occasioned by the mystery, but by humanity itself. The mystery of Golgotha caused the tiny flame to grow ever brighter, but it appears to be faint compared to the powerful light that shone upon the soul from all sides before the event, because progressing human nature was sinking ever deeper into darkness. Thus the mystery of Golgotha is not to be blamed for the tamas condition of the soul as it relates to the spirit. Rather, the spirit made it possible for the tamas condition to come again in the distant future into the sattva condition, which is now kindled from within outward. In the sense of the Sankhya philosophy, the rajas condition lies between that of sattva and tamas, and is characteristic of the evolutionary period in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred. As to the manifesting spirit, humanity itself went the way from light to darkness, from the sattva to the tamas condition, during the thousands of years surrounding the mystery of Golgotha. To make it more exact, and then here's a picture, a line A to B, the Chaldean Egyptian, underneath it says Chaldean Egyptian, and then in the middle Greco-Roman, and on the right today, and above those in two sections, the 7th century BC lies between the Chaldean Egyptian and the Greco-Roman, and the 15th century lies between Greco-Roman and today. If we indicate the evolution of mankind by the line A to B, up to about the 8th or 7th century BC, all human culture was in the sattva condition. Then began the age in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred, and around the 15th or 16th century AD, a transition to the tamas age definitely set in. Using our customary terms, the first epoch, which for certain spiritual revelations fell into the sattva condition, coincided with what we call the Egypto-Chaldean period. What was of the Rajas condition came in the Greco-Latin epoch. That of the Tamas condition is in our own age. We know that in post-Atlantean times this Egypto-Chaldean era is the third, the Greco-Latin the fourth, and ours the fifth. There had to take place, we might say, according to the plan of human evolution, a deadening of outer revelation in passing from the third into the fourth period. How was mankind actually prepared for the flashing up of the Christ impulse? If we wish to be clear about how man's spiritual relationships in the Egypto-Chaldean epoch differed from those of the following epochs, we must recognize that in this third period the people in all those lands, including India, still possessed a remnant of the old clairvoyance. That means they not only saw the world through their senses and their intelligence bound to the brain, but also through the organs of the etheric body, at least under certain conditions between sleeping and waking. To picture a man of that era, we must recognize that for everyone viewing the outer world of nature as we do now through our physical senses and reasoning, this was but one way of experiencing the world. They did not arrive at knowledge. They only looked at things as they were in action, side by side in space, and successively in time. To achieve knowledge, they had to come into a certain condition, not cultivated, as with us, but quite natural, which happened as if by itself, as the deeper forces of their etheric bodies were aroused so as to produce knowledge. Out of such knowledge emerged all the wonderful wisdom that appeared in the Sankhya philosophy, also what has come down to us in the wisdom of the Vedas, though this belonged to a more ancient time. Thus man attained knowledge in that time, either by bringing himself into another state of consciousness, or feeling himself transported into it. He had his everyday consciousness, in which he used his eyes and ears and carried on his activities with his ordinary intelligence, but he used these faculties only in his outer practical affairs. It would not have occurred to him to attain knowledge or science by such means. For this he had to employ what came to him in another state of mind, wherein he activated his deeper forces. So, we can conceive man in that ancient time as having his everyday body, and within this his finer spiritual body, his Sunday body, if I may put it so. With his everyday body he did his everyday work. With his Sunday body, woven only out of the etheric body, he perceived and developed his science. It would be correct to say that a man of that time would be astonished that he now obtained knowledge by means of our everyday body, never putting on our Sunday bodies when we want to know something about the world. How then did a man of that time experience all these conditions? When he gained knowledge through his deeper powers, for instance, in developing the Sankhya philosophy, he did not feel as man today feels, who, when he wants to gain knowledge, has to strain his intellect and think with his head. To gain knowledge, he felt himself to be in his ether body, which was only slightly extended into what today is the physical head, but was more defined in the other parts of the body. Man then thought much more with the other members of his etheric body. In the head, the ether body was the least developed, so that in thinking a man felt lifted out of his physical body. But in such moments of forming knowledge, of scientific thinking, he felt also as if he were united with the earth. When he took off his everyday body and put on his Sunday body, he felt as though forces flowed through his whole being, as when forces coursing through our limbs and feet connect us with the earth, and when flowing through our hands and arms connect themselves with our body. He began to feel himself as part of the earth. On one side, he was aware of thinking and knowing in his ether body, and on the other that he was no longer a separated man, but a part of the earth. He felt himself growing into the earth. Thus the whole inner way of experiencing changed when a man put on his Sunday body and prepared to gain knowledge. What then had to happen to bring this third epoch to a close and let the fourth one enter? If we wish to understand this, it would be well if we felt our way into the whole way of designating things. A man in that ancient time who experienced what I have been describing would say, quote, "The serpent has become active within me," unquote. His being had been extended into the earth. He felt his physical body not as the active part of him, but that a serpent-like appendage of himself stretched into the earth, and the head was what stuck out of the earth. He felt this serpent being to be the thinker. He could indicate it so. His ether body stretched into the earth like a serpent, and while he, as physical man, was outside the earth, when he was thinking and understanding, he penetrated the earth and thought with his ether body. So in ancient times, to apprehend something meant, quote, "I stir into action the serpent within me. I feel my serpent nature," unquote. What then had to happen to bring about the new way of knowing? It was to be no longer possible for man to feel himself extended into the earth through his limbs and feet. Also, feeling had to die away in his ether body, and had to pass instead into his physical head. If you correctly picture this change, you will find it well expressed by saying, quote, "One is wounded in the feet, but with his own body he crushes the serpent's head," unquote, which means the serpent's head ceases to be the organ of thinking. The physical brain kills the serpent, which takes revenge by withdrawing man's feeling of belonging to the earth. It bites one on the heel. At such times of transition from one form of human experience to another, there is conflict, since the two forms still exist side by side. A father is still there after the son has lived for years, yet the son bears in him what derives from the father. The characteristics of the fourth, the Greco-Latin epoch, were present while those of the third epoch were still active in people and nations. Such intermingling naturally goes with evolution. But the influx of the old, and the old receding alongside it, brings it about that they do not understand each other well. The old does not understand the new. The new must protect itself from the old, must assert its life in the face of it. Yet while the new is there, the forefathers, who have not assimilated the new, project their qualities into their descendants. In this way we can characterize the transition from the third to the fourth period of human culture. Now, there had to be a hero, one might say, a leader who is an outstanding representative of this process of killing the serpent and being wounded by it, and who at the same time has to rebel against what, to be sure, is related to him, but whose faculties still shine into the new, out of the past era. Humanity must go forward in such a way that what generations are to experience, some one person must first experience in its full greatness. Who was this hero who killed the head of the serpent and rebelled against the significance of the third epoch, leading mankind out of the old Satwa period into that of Tamas? This hero was Krishna. How could this be more definitely indicated than by the Oriental legend showing Krishna as a son of the gods Mahadeva and Devaki, who entered the world amid wonderful happenings, that is, as a bringer of something new? Continuing with my analogy, he leads men to seek knowledge by way of their everyday bodies. He slays the Sunday body, the serpent. He has to resist what his kindred bring over into the new age. Such a person is something new, wonderful. So the legend relates how Krishna, already at birth, was surrounded by miraculous occurrences, and that his uncle Kansa sought to kill him. Here in his uncle we see the in-thrust of the old forces that Krishna had to oppose in order to kill off the influences of the third epoch, hindering mankind's evolution. He had to rebel against Kansa as being of the old Satwa era. Among the most significant miracles surrounding Krishna, the legend tells how the powerful serpent Kali wound around him, but he succeeded in crushing its head, whereby he was wounded on the heel. Thus the legend directly reflects an occult fact, as legends do. One should not give superficial explanations of legends, but really understand them, see them in the right relation to true knowledge. Krishna is the hero of the declining third post-Atlantean epoch. The legend tells us that he appeared at the end of this age, so everything hangs together when rightly understood. Krishna is the one who killed the old faculty of perception and cast it into darkness. He did this in his outer manifestations, bringing into eclipse what had surrounded mankind earlier as Satwa knowledge. He is shown in the Bhagavad Gita as the one who gives to one single person, to compensate for what he had taken away, instruction for attaining through yoga what to normal humanity was being lost. Thus, for the world, Krishna is the destroyer of the old sattva knowledge. And at the same time, he appears at the end of the Gita as the Lord of Yoga, who leads the way again to the knowledge that has been left behind, that knowledge which can only be recovered if man ceases to be dominated by what he has drawn about him like everyday clothes and returns to the old spiritual condition. Such was the twofold deed of Krishna. As a world historical hero, he crushed the head of the old serpent knowledge and forced humanity to enter into the physical body, whereas earlier everything contributing to man's egohood streamed into him from outside. From now on it would only be possible by means of the physical body to develop his ego as a free, self-dependent entity. Thus Krishna was a world historical hero. He restored to individual man for meditation, contemplation, and inner discovery what was once lost. It is this which enters in such a grand way in the Gita scene that we let work upon our souls at the end of the lecture yesterday. Arjuna confronting his own nature, but seen outwardly, outspread through all space, without beginning or end. If we examine the Gita exactly, we come to a place in the Gita that again makes us wonder at its limitless greatness. People today must find this passage impossible to explain. It is where Krishna reveals to Arjuna the nature of the Avayata tree, the fig tree, saying that with this tree the roots grow upward and the branches downward, that its single leaves are those of the Veda book, which together contain the Veda knowledge. Now, this is a peculiar passage. What does it mean? To understand it, we must go back to the old knowledge and see clearly its effects. Man today only gains knowledge through his physical organs. The old knowledge was gained, as we have said, through the etheric body. Not that the total man was etheric, but his knowledge came through the part of his ether body that was in the physical. Imagine for a moment that you are perceiving in your etheric body with its serpent. That was an objective fact which no longer exists for man today. At present, he observes much in his environment quite naturally, but look at him as he views the world. There is one thing he does not see. No man can see his own brain when he is observing. No one can see the marrow of his own spine. But this impossibility ceases when one observes by means of the ether body. Then a new object appears. Otherwise invisible, he sees his own nervous system. But he certainly does not see it as an anatomist at present sees it. Rather, he has the feeling, quote, "There you are in your etheric nature. You look upward and see how the nerves spread into all the organs, collecting together up in the brain. You feel that it is a tree, with its roots stretching upward and its branches extending down into all the limbs." Unquote. Actually, this is not experienced as small enough to be contained within our own skin, but as a great world tree, the roots reaching out into space and the branches downward. One feels himself a serpent, seeing this nerve system objectively before him. Remember that in earlier lectures I said that man, in a certain sense, is a plant upside down. We must put all our observations together to understand this remarkable scene in the Gita. Above everything, one marvels at that ancient wisdom which today must be brought to light again by new methods out of the depths of occultism. Then one experiences what this tree reveals, what it is that grows out of it as leaves, the Veda knowledge streaming into one from outside. The wonderful picture of the Gita now stands before us, the tree with its roots going upward, its branches downward, its leaves containing knowledge, and man himself, the serpent, on the tree. Perhaps you have already seen this picture of the tree of life with the serpent. Everything has significance when one looks into all these ancient symbols. Here we encounter the tree, its roots extending upward, its branches downward. One has the feeling he is in the reverse position to the tree of paradise, and that has a deep meaning. For the tree of paradise stands at the initial point of another chapter of evolution, that which works on through the old Hebraic era into Christianity. Here, then, is indicated the whole nature of ancient knowledge. When Krishna explicitly says to his pupil Arjuna, quote, "Renunciation is the power that makes this tree visible to man," unquote, he indicates how man turns back to that ancient knowledge by giving up everything he has attained in the subsequent course of evolution, which we described yesterday. This is the glorious gift that Krishna makes to this single individual, his pupil Arjuna, as payment on account for what he had to take away from humanity in general for their everyday use. That is the essence of Krishna. What must Krishna's gift to his individual pupil become? It must become sattva wisdom. The more clearly Krishna gives this wisdom to Arjuna, the more profound, serene, and passionless it will be. But it will be an old revealed wisdom, given to man from outside, in the wonderful words spoken by the noble Krishna himself, and expressed again in his single pupil's response. Thus Krishna becomes the Lord of Yoga, who leads back to the primal wisdom of mankind. Always does he seek to overcome that soul force that even in the sattva age concealed the spirit. He wants to bring to his pupil what the spirit was in its primal purity before descending into material substance. So only in spirit does Krishna stand before us in that dialogue with Arjuna that we presented yesterday. With this we come to the end of that epoch that saw the last of the old spirituality. We could follow it so as to see the total spiritual light at its beginning, and then its decline into materiality, in order that man find his independence, his ego. When the spiritual light had come as far as the fourth epoch, a kind of transition set in, a rajas condition, between spirit and the outer soul faculty. In this period the mystery of Golgotha occurred. Can one describe this era in terms of sattva? No. One would miss just what belonged to that age. To express correctly something in the rajas age, using this term as in the Sankhya philosophy, one must not speak out of the state of detachment, but out of the personal, out of the indignation over this and that. In this way, Paul spoke out of the rajas condition. Just feel the throb of many a word in his letters to the Thessalonians, the Corinthians, the Romans, the struggling to get free of something, the rage, the personality characteristics often breaking through. That is the style and character of these epistles. They must be so, while the Bhagavad Gita must be detached and personality-free, since it is the finest blossoming of the declining age. But to every man it gives a substitute for what is being lost and leads him back to the heights of spiritual life. Krishna had to give his own pupil the highest blossoming of the spirit because he was required to kill the old knowledge for humanity, to crush the head of the serpent. The sattva condition had faded out by itself. It was no longer there. Anyone speaking of the sattva condition while in the following rajas era could only have referred to it as something ancient. A person living at the beginning of the new age had to express what now was the determining influence. Personality had entered human nature through its seeking knowledge by means of the organs and processes of the physical body it had begun to use. That personal element speaks from the Pauline epistles. His personality thunders his indignation about everything bearing the darkness of materiality. His letters often reverberate with words of anger. But this also means that these letters cannot speak in the severely conclusive phrases, with a wisdom-filled, sharply delineated detachment to be found in the Bhagavad Gita. Such wisdom can only be spoken when a man is free from outer concerns, and is lifted triumphantly to the spirit, where he becomes one with Krishna. Thus can one describe the wisdom-filled path of yoga to the greatest heights of soul. The new element in the world, the victory of the spirit over the merely soul-like, could only be described out of the rajas condition. He who first did so in a way vitally important to human history described it with utmost enthusiasm, in such a way that people knew he was deeply involved, shaken to the roots as he confronted the manifestation of the Christ. In that moment he encountered it personally. For the first time he confronted what henceforth would be working for thousands of years into the future. It took hold of him so as to personally seize upon all the powers of his soul. Therefore he did not describe it in the philosophical, wisdom-filled, definitive concepts of the Bhagavad Gita, but had to tell of the resurrection of Christ as an event of direct personal involvement. Should it then not be a personal experience? Should Christianity not permeate the intimately personal, filling it with warmth and life? Truly, he who described the Christ event for the first time could only do so personally. In the Gita, the main thought lies in rising to spiritual heights through yoga. Everything else is only touched upon. Why is this? Because Krishna, in giving his instruction, deals with this one pupil, not with what other men feel as their relation to the spiritual. So Krishna describes what his pupil should become, achieving ever higher spiritual realms. What he describes leads to ever more mature conditions of soul, therefore to ever more impressive and beautiful pictures. Also, only in conclusion do we see the contrast between what is spiritual and what is demonic, which somewhat confirms the beauty inherent in the soul's ascent. All those out of whom only the material speaks, who live in materiality, who believe that with death all is finished, these are demonic in nature. But what is said merely to enlighten, the great teacher really is little concerned with it. Above all, his task is the spiritualizing of the human soul. Only in passing may yoga speak of its opponent. Paul, above everything, has to do with humanity as a whole, which lives at the time when darkness is breaking in upon it. He has to orient his view to everything this epoch of darkness brings about in human life. He must show the contrast between this darkening influence common to all and the seedling to be brought to life in the human soul as the Christ impulse. He also is to point up every aspect of materialism, every possible vice that has to be battled against by what he has to give. This at first is like a tiny flickering flame in the soul, and can only gain strength if there is enthusiasm behind his words, words pressing to victory, revealing a personalized power of feeling. So remote from each other are the presentations of the Gita and the epistles. In the Gita, detached, impersonal description, but Paul must work personal expression into his words. This accounts for the tone and style of both, showing in almost every line. Artistic perfection can be achieved only after maturity. At the beginning of a development, there is bound to be more or less chaos. How is it that all this happened as it did? We find the answer if we return to the striking beginning of the Gita poem, where we saw how the related warriors opposed each other man to man, the victors and the vanquished alike connected by blood ties. The time had come for passing from the old blood relationships on which clairvoyance depended to differentiating and mixing the blood streams as characterizes the New Age. This involves a transformation of the outer physical nature of man and the changes in cognition necessarily connected with it. A different kind of blood mixing, another meaning for blood, now enters human evolution. If we study this passing from that ancient era to the new one, parenthesis, you may recall my booklet, The Occult Significance of the Blood, parenthesis, we find that the clairvoyance of ancient times was dependent on people having the same tribal blood. Whereas, with the mixing of tribes, the old clairvoyance was destroyed, and the new cognition, bound to the physical body, superseded it. The beginning of the Gita points to something external that is bound to the human form. Especially in the Sankhya philosophy are such form transformations mentioned. What pertains to the soul is, so to say, left in the background, as we pointed out. Souls in their multiplicity simply exist behind the forms. We found a kind of pluralism in the Sankhya philosophy, which we could compare with the philosophy of Leibniz in the modern age. If we thought ourselves into the soul of a Sankhya philosopher, we could imagine him saying, quote, "Here is my soul, expressing itself either in the sattva, rajas, or tamas condition, as it relates to the forms of the external body," unquote. But this philosopher would observe that these forms change. One of the most significant changes shows in the different way of using the etheric body or in the transition in blood relations that we described. This is an outer change in form. The soul is not touched by what the Sankhya philosophy is concerned with. The outer changes of form suffice for considering the transition from the old sattva era to the new rajas era on the boundary of which Krishna stands. Here it is the external transformations in form, more external to the soul, that come into consideration. Outer changes in form were always to be considered when one epoch passed into another. With the transition of the Persian into the Egyptian era, there was a change different from that of the Egyptian to the Greco-Latin. Further back, from the primeval Indian to the Persian, was a still different change in form, but a change did occur then also. In fact, it was merely a change in form that marked the passing of old Atlantis to the post-Atlantean world. One can follow this through the indications given in Sankhya philosophy, which show that the soul lives in these forms, but is not influenced by them. Purusha remains untouched. Thus we find a remarkable kind of change that Sankhya philosophy expresses through its own concepts. But behind it stands Purusha, the individual soul quality of every person. So this philosophy merely says that this individual soul element exists in the external relation of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas, but is not disturbed by them. The teachings of Krishna, Lord of Yoga, point continually to the soul element, certainly. But knowledge as to the real nature of the soul is not forthcoming. Guidance as to how the soul should develop is the highest he imparts. Change in the outer forms, no change in the soul itself, only hinting at such a change. This hinting we discover in the following way. When a man desires to rise through yoga from the ordinary to the higher soul levels, he must free himself from outer activities, from worldly knowledge. He must become his own observer. By rising above all externalities, the soul gains its inner freedom. This is the case with ordinary humanity. But with a person who enters upon initiation and becomes clairvoyant, this does not remain so. Outer materiality does not confront him, for it as such is Maya. It is reality only for one who can use his own inner instruments. Now, what is it that takes the place of matter? That comes before us when we look at the initiation of olden times. While the ordinary man in his everyday life confronts matter, prakriti, the soul of one becoming initiated through yoga faces the world of the asuras, the world of demoniacal powers, which he has to fight. Matter is that which provides resistance. The asuras, the powers of darkness, they are the enemy. But all that is only hinted at. There, so to say, we glimpse something of the soul, and we begin to feel what the soul is. For the first time, then, in doing battle with the demons, the asuras, this soul activity perceives its own being spiritually. In our language, we would designate this battle, though it appears only in miniature, as that which becomes visible as spirits in action, when matter shows its spiritual nature. Even in miniature, it appears to be what we know as the soul's battle with Ahriman, when it enters upon initiation. But even in doing this, we remain entirely within the soul's being. Then that which was formerly the material spirits grows to gigantic size, and the soul confronts a mighty foe. Soul stands against soul, the individual soul against Ahriman's kingdom in the wide expanse of the universe. The lowest level of Ahriman's kingdom is what one fights in yoga. But now Ahriman himself confronts us, observed as we express it. His full powers, his whole kingdom opposes the human soul. The Sankhya philosophy knows the relationship of the soul to outer materiality, when the latter has the upper hand as the tamas condition. One initiated through yoga is not only in this tamas condition, he is battling against certain demonic powers, into which, to his view, matter has been changed. In our conception, we see the soul not only when it relates to the spiritual element in matter, but when it confronts the purely spiritual, the Ahrimanic element. In the Rajas state, according to Sankhya philosophy, matter and spirit are in balance. They swing back and forth, first one is high up, then the other. When this condition leads to initiation, then, in the spirit of the old yoga, it would lead to an overcoming of Rajas into Sattva. For us it does not yet lead to Sattva, but here another battle begins, the battle with Lucifer. Now as we view it, we confront Purusha, which is only hinted at in the Sankhya philosophy. Not that we merely hint at it now. It actually stands right in the center of the battleground against Ahriman and Lucifer, soul opposing soul. Purusha appears to Sankhya philosophy as primevally distant. When we go deeper into what there enters the soul's nature, still indistinguishable from the Ahrimanic and Luciferic elements, then in sattva, rajas, tamas, there are only the soul's relations to material substance. In our terms, we now find the soul between Ahriman and Lucifer, vigorously struggling and battling with them. This is something that could be seen for the first time in its whole magnitude through Christianity. In the old Sankhya teaching, Purusha was, so to say, left undisturbed. There the condition was described that arose when Purusha clothed itself in Prakriti. When we enter the Christian age and into its esoteric foundations, we can penetrate Purusha itself, characterizing its threefold form as the soul, the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic elements. We are now concerned with the inner condition of the soul itself in its struggle. What had to come lay in the transition occurring within the fourth epoch through the mystery of Golgotha. What then happened? With the passing of the third into the fourth epoch came what may be described as merely a change of form, yet it now involved the transition from Prakriti to Purusha itself, by which one inwardly felt how Purusha was completely emancipated from Prakriti. Man was not only torn away from his blood ties, but away from Prakriti, set free of everything external to him. He must now come to terms with it in his inner nature. Here the Christ impulse enters into him, the greatest transition that could have occurred in the whole of earth evolution. No longer does the question arise as to how the soul relates to matter in sattva, rajas, and tamas. For then the soul had not only to conquer tamas and rajas in order to lift itself above them in yoga, but it was left to itself to fight against Ahriman and Lucifer. Then begins the necessity to come to terms with what the past epoch had required, and with the demands of the new age as this is represented in the song of the Bhagavad Gita. This poem shows us the conflict. There the human soul is revealed, living in its bodily sheaths, whose forms are continually changing. As long as the soul lives in them, it is ensnared by the ordinary life of Prakriti. Then in yoga the soul escapes this entanglement, breaks out of its restraining sheaths, and enters the spiritual sphere entirely free. However, it is not enough that the soul merely frees itself. Here we have to consider what Christianity, the mystery of Golgotha, brought into evolution for the first time. Through yoga, the soul would make itself free. Then it could attain a vision of Krishna in his full power. But this would be Krishna as he was before Ahriman and Lucifer had attained their full power. A kind divinity still concealed the fact that on either side of Krishna, visible in the exalted way we described yesterday, stood Ahriman and Lucifer. Such concealment was possible in old clairvoyance, because man had not yet descended into matter. But that condition can no longer continue. If now the soul merely passes through yoga, it would confront Ahriman and Lucifer and have to fight them. But the soul could not take its place beside Krishna without the help of that ally who does do battle with Ahriman and Lucifer. Tamas and Rajas do not suffice. This firm ally is the Christ. Thus we see how the bodily nature frees itself from the body, or we could also say the bodily nature was darkened in the body when the great hero, Krishna, appeared. On the other hand, we see something more powerful, how the soul abandoned to itself becomes exposed to the battle, something only visible in its own domain in the age when the mystery of Golgotha took place. I can well understand, my dear friends, that someone may say, quote, "Truly, what still greater vision can there be than to see in the vision of Krishna man's highest ideal, the perfection of humanity?" Unquote. There can be something higher. It is that which must stand by us and permeate us when we first confront the powers in the spirit, not merely tamas and rajas, but the powers we must conquer if we are to gain this lofty human state. The force to help us is the Christ. So, if one wills to see the highest only in what Krishna stands for, one is prevented from seeing something still higher only by his own inability to do so. Then, too, the superiority of the Christ impulse over that of Krishna is shown in the fact that the being incarnated in Krishna was incarnated in his total humanness. Krishna was born and grew to manhood as the son of Visuddeva, but in his whole human development lived that highest human impulse that we recognize as Krishna. But that impulse which must come to our aid when we confront Lucifer and Ahriman, parenthesis, this confrontation, which like all the other things we have described in our mystery dramas, exists only in its beginning and will be comprehensible for man in future, parenthesis, that must be an impulse too great for mankind to contain as yet, an impulse that could not even live in such a body as Zarathustra could live in, but only when this body had attained the height of development, that is, when it had reached its 30th year. For this reason, the Christ impulse cannot last throughout a whole life, but only through its ripest years. Thus it is that this impulse was present in the body of Jesus for only 3 years. It is shown again directly in this fact that the Christ impulse stands higher than that of Krishna from birth onward. As to how the superiority of the Christ impulse shows itself further, we will still have more to say. But you will have seen and felt, from what has already been described, that the relation between the great Gita and the epistles of Paul must in truth be as we have indicated, because the Gita is the ripe fruit of many previous epochs. It can be a finished creation. The epistles, being the first seeds of a ripening, more perfect and comprehensive period in history yet to come, are of necessity much more imperfect. So in viewing the course of world history, one must recognize the imperfection of the Pauline epistles when comparing them to the Gita, those most significant imperfections which should not be passed over. But also, one should understand why these imperfections are inevitably there. The end of Lecture 4.